Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, we're just in it for fun and see what happens. And you know, the fun part will be a little bit afterwards when we get to try everybody else's Dutch oven recipes as well.
Scott Griffith is a first-time participant in the Patoka Lake Dutch Oven Cook-Off. We'll be spending much of the show today with him and a few other good-natured amateur cooks, perfect for a brisk fall day. If it's a little too chilly to spend time outside, why not put on a pot of soup to cook and cuddle up inside instead? Chef Daniel Orr has a good idea for a recipe. We visit a bison farm before that, and we speak with the man who helped found the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Lots ahead today on Earth Eats. The biggest news of the week, obviously, the elections. Lou Anne Johnson has a rundown for us.
There were several high-profile food and agriculture-related issues on ballots this week that we kept our eye on, but only a couple would become laws. Let's start in Hawaii. Voters in Maui County passed an initiative that temporarily stops the farming of GMO crops. Monsanto and Dow Chemical have already said they will challenge the rule. The companies conduct field trials on Maui farms, and they grow seeds for commercial distribution there as well. The ban is being called temporary because the initiative states that Maui County will conduct tests to determine the health effects of GMO food and farming. Two GMO labeling initiatives went down in defeat. In Colorado, it was 66% against labeling versus 34% in favor. In Oregon, the margin was much tighter. Fewer than 51% said no to GMO labeling. Lots and lots of cash was funneled into defeating these ballot measures. $15 million in Colorado alone. In Oregon, it was a state record $18 million in anti-GMO labeling money. It should surprise no one that most of those funds came from seed corporations like Monsanto and packaged food producers like Pepsi. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports that the failed measures follow a nationwide trend. Similar ballot questions in California and Washington State were rejected in 2012 and 2013, respectively. And two soda taxes appeared on Tuesday's ballot, one in San Francisco and one in Berkeley. Come Wednesday morning, only one measure has passed. Berkeley passed a 1 cent per ounce tax on sugary beverages by a landslide 75%. The San Francisco measure received a majority vote, but because it laid out where the taxes would be spent, it needed a two-thirds vote to pass. Some viewed the passage of Berkeley's soda tax as a victory and a sign of things to come. Marion Nessel compiled several responses that were hopeful Berkeley would set the stage for a nationwide change. Others are more skeptical that Berkeley, a small liberal town with a major university, will actually be representative of the rest of the country. There is some evidence that taxation of unhealthy foods does decrease consumption, like in the case of Mexico's junk food tax. Consumption of junk food decreased by 10% in the first 3 months of the tax. Berkeley's law will go into effect January of 2015. There's so much more to unpack about the recent elections. Be sure to visit eartheats.org to read more articles, share links, and add your 2 cents.
Twitter is really the place to go if you have 2 cents to add. We post stories there. We interact with you. We try to keep up with all the food and ag happenings. Find us at Earth Eats. Lou Anne, you're the best.
Thanks, Annie. Till next time.
We love talking to chefs in fancy restaurant kitchens, obviously, but sometimes it's nice to go hang out in the woods and do some old-fashioned outdoor cooking with regular folks. I was excited to do just that a couple weeks ago at Patoka Lake in southern Indiana. They have this annual event called the Autumn Getaway. More than 2,000 campers were spending the weekend in the state park. Kids were throwing footballs. There were campfires all over the place, lots of folks on bikes. Then over in a tent, there were 14 groups of people huddled around large cast iron pots on picnic tables. That's the 12th annual Dutch Oven Cook-Off. Participants in the cook-off have 3 hours to cook a main dish, a soup, or a dessert in a Dutch oven. A group of judges determine first, second, and third prizes in each category. Then all the campers at Patoka Lake are invited to taste the dishes, and they vote on the taster's choice, the most popular dish that year. Most people are in it for the conversation, not the competition. Let's meet some of them.
You know, they're unfair advantage. They have candy.
Jonathan Brandt is slinging some good-natured trash talk at another cook, Billy Gilmore.
On the table. That's going to sway the judges for sure.
Candies are just there for show, for looks. They don't have anything to do with our recipe.
It's not a bad idea, though. You could kind of sprinkle those on top.
Billy's recipe is called an untraditional caramel apple cobbler. Jonathan is making a turkey soup.
So we're not going to be directly up against the candy here.
Back over at their picnic table, Jonathan's wife Mindy is chopping kale and carrots for the stew. She's confident this recipe is going to be tasty.
I think it has a lot of flavor. It's hard to make a soup that has flavor the day you make it. Usually they taste better later, but this one tastes good, I think, the day of. So that's the trick, because it has to be judged the day of you make it. So.
Mindy and Jonathan have been participating in the cook-off since the very beginning. They're old pros. Mindy, this year, convinced her sister to also enter the competition.
But I wore my apron just to look more professional, like a cooker.
Sue Nelson.
I asked about an electric mixer if I could plug one in, and she said no. We're doing it from scratch like our relatives did.
Sue is a newbie. She's putting the ingredients together for a peach upside-down cake. So, Dutch ovens. These are cast iron pots. You can cook with them over a fire, but today our cooks are putting them in two metal pans and using hot coals instead. You know, fire hazard. These pots have legs so you can put coals underneath, and the lid has a lip so you can place coals on top as well. The idea is you get a consistent heat so you can put the food in the Dutch oven, go on a nice long hike, and when you get back, boom, there's dinner. Jonathan has been cooking with a Dutch oven since his sons were in Boy Scouts, so he's helping Sue and her husband Bob get their dessert cooking.
We're just, you know, the number of coals is really important. You want to put very few below the Dutch oven and many more. So for this peach dessert dish, there will be 6 coals below and, what did you say, Sue? 18 will be on top, and it creates a real even heat, especially for something that's going to be like an upside-down cake where you really want to make sure it cooks all the way through.
Are we ready to go, Jonathan?
I put it in upside down. So, you
know, yeah. Okay, flip it over. Yeah. There you go. Ready?
Then we're to do 45 minutes. And we're to turn it regularly so that the coals don't burn the bottom. But I don't know, does that seem like enough? It doesn't seem like enough charcoal to me, but I'm not going to worry about it right now.
I guess we'll wait and see.
Yeah. Well, we'll wait and see until we get done here, whether we have cake or soup.
I'm pouring the topping in right now for the pumpkin pie. It's the cake mix that we're making, and we're going to mix in butter and pecans in it, too.
A few picnic tables away is the youngest cook at today's event, okay. Maria Hopper. She's 11, and she's confident she's going to win.
Yeah.
Maria's family has been coming to the Autumn Getaway and watching the cook-off for 6 years. Heather Hopper is Maria's mom.
She got real excited last year. With probably the year prior when we were watching it, we decided we could probably do something. And so they got their Dutch ovens for Christmas, and then we did the cook-off last year, and we came back this year.
Well, I won last year for desserts, and I made s'mores, and I'm hoping to win with pumpkin pie.
Hi.
How are you?
Are you newbies?
We are newbies.
Gabrielle Martin and Scott Griffith are a new couple, and they wanted to do something together, so they decided to try the cook-off.
We are getting ready to chop up some of our vegetables for our chicken tortilla soup.
Describe what is going to go in this.
Peppers, onions, chicken, got tomatoes, beans, just about anything you'd find in a fajita, basically.
All right, so there's some people here who've been competing for all 12 years.
Yes, I know that.
You know, we're just in it for fun and see what happens. And you know, The fun part will be a little bit afterwards when we get to try everybody else's Dutch oven recipes as well. We get to taste everybody's.
But you want to win, right?
Yes.
Of course we want to win.
All right, now we wait. Back in a bit to check on our cooks and their Dutch ovens. If a catastrophic plant disease wipes out the crops that we rely on to feed us, we might turn to the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Close to 1 million seed packets in the vault are tucked inside a frozen mountain on a Norwegian island. It includes samples from similar vaults in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Ames, Iowa. And the man who pushed for the vault's creation, Carrie Fowler, says the facility will be essential to plant researchers as they attempt to help farmers adapt to climate change. He spoke with Luke Runyon.
You're probably best known for the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. A lot of people refer to these seed vaults as doomsday vaults. Can you talk a little bit about how that came to be and why it's so important?
I think there are two misconceptions, particularly about the seed vault near the North Pole. One is that it's a facility that's going to supply seeds to farmers all over the world if something bad happens, and no seed bank in the world can do that. It's really meant for breeding material to create new adapted varieties. And the other is that we built it because we anticipated some kind of doomsday, and that term never entered our minds until the place was under construction. And there was an article in a magazine, and I guess a headline writer put Doomsday Vault on it, and all of a sudden, frankly, the media, which had never been interested in this topic at all, totally bored by this topic for about 30 years of my life, all of a sudden the phone started ringing. What is this about a doomsday vault? So the real problem and why we built that facility and why seed banks exist is to provide plant breeders with breeding material.
Can you talk a little bit about what the vault looks like and give a few facts about what's actually in there?
Sure. Well, from the outside, there's just a little wedge sticking out of the side of this mountain, very high up the mountain. And it looks like some kind of thing from 2001 Space Odyssey. But once you open up the doors, you're peering down this long, very simple tunnel. And the tunnel goes about 130 meters into the mountainside. And at the end of that are three vault rooms. And each is capable of storing 1.5 million samples of seeds, though we're only storing seeds in one of those rooms right now. So that's sort of physically what it looks like.
I've always heard these seed vaults described as global insurance policies for plant life and agriculture to keep going. What are we talking about when we talk about crop diversity? And why is it an important topic for people to consider?
Most people don't pause to think too much about crop diversity. They go to the store, and for them, it's brown rice, white rice, and Uncle Ben's. And that's about it. But there are a couple of 100,000 different varieties of rice, a couple of 100,000 different varieties of wheat, and probably 30,000, 40,000 different kinds of beans. And all of this is not just nice and pretty. It is. And it's not just worthy of existing. I do believe it is. But it's the raw material for plant evolution. And the definition, I think, of extinction is when something loses the ability to evolve. Because when any species loses the ability to evolve, it's just a waiting game until the last individual dies. But it will happen. So we need this diversity to help agriculture adapt to whatever is going to come in the future.
What would you say are some of the biggest threats to crop diversity throughout the world right now? And what would you say are going to be some threats down the line?
Well, I think probably the biggest threat continues to be the modernization of agriculture and growing uniformity in agriculture, particularly in developing countries. But if you put that aside for a while, because that's been there for a long time, I would say that climate change is number 1 through 5 of the top threats. Climate change is going to change so many things about our agricultural system. And it is going to disadvantage some crops. It's going to disadvantage farmer varieties in developing countries where you still have a lot of diversity that hasn't been collected, hasn't been put in seed banks or the seed vault near the North Pole. And that's going to result in a lot of displacement of existing diversity in the world.
That's Kerry Fowler, who spearheaded the construction of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault near the North Pole. He's also a former director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org.
So we're at Buffalo Run, and that's located in what part of Indiana?
We're in Lincoln City, Indiana, which is kind of halfway between Louisville, Kentucky, and Evansville, Indiana. And we're also located in Abraham Lincoln's boyhood home in Lincoln City.
Oh, that's so much fun.
Chef Daniel Orr, out of the kitchen for once, and on a field trip to chat with Kathleen Cruz at Buffalo Run Farm. Bison, also commonly called American buffalo, is America's original red meat because it was the main protein source for Plains Indians until the animals were nearly hunted to extinction in the late 19th century. These days, in addition to wild bison herds in national parks and nature preserves, farms are keeping bison as livestock. In addition to raising bison, they have Devon cattle, a heritage breed of cows that's known for the rich milk used in Devonshire cream.
And they were with the first colonial settlers that came to America. And what's really neat about them, they have a distinct look. They are kind of what I call red.
Uh-huh.
And they have horns. The males and the females have horns, just like the buffalo. They can be dairy animals, beef animals, or draft animals. So
draft meaning that they can be work animals.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, we see the bison kind of coming in here as a small herd. Are there any challenges in raising bison that make them different from cows?
Well, you don't normally use a cattle prod. They go where they want to go, when they want to go, because they're so big, and they're very agile, very athletic. They can run 35 miles an hour. They can jump a 6-foot fence if they want to. What we have learned, though, is if you run electric about nose high on them, they'll sting their nose when they try to get the grass on the other side of the fence that's always greener.
Right.
And then they think the whole thing is hot, and they think, maybe I won't do that. They are otherwise pretty easy to deal with as long as they have a water source and as long as they have plenty of grass.
Kathleen Cruz introducing us to the animals on her Buffalo Run farm. Daniel will take up his post at the stove in the second half of the show, cooking some beef brisket for a stew. Then we check in with our competitors at the Dutch Oven Cook-Off. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's Earth Eats, back at Patoka Lake.
You're making a mess,
babe. Everywhere here.
I'm Annie Corrigan. Scott Griffith and Gabrielle Martin are pouring cans of beans and tomatoes in the pot for their chicken tortilla soup. They have more prep than just about anybody here today. Things are a little stressful at this picnic table.
And believe it or not, our Dutch oven is almost full and we still have all the vegetables.
And chicken to put in.
And chicken to put in.
You are at the tippy top.
Yeah.
You still have more chicken to go in. I don't know if you have enough room.
Yeah, we're going to have enough room.
Meanwhile, Maria Hopper is calm, confident.
Have you been lifting the lid to check it out?
Yeah. It's all getting crusty. It's been cooking for about 35 minutes.
When do we get to taste it?
In about 30 minutes. But we have whipped topping to go on it. It's going to be all warm, delicious.
No need to watch the Dutch oven do its thing, so she goes on a walk to check out her competition.
Ooh, what's this? Ooh, it's a caramel apple cobbler. Not pumpkin pie, but it's dessert. Sweet corn pudding. Mmm.
Are you nervous?
Yeah. I had to say I am. There's more desserts than last year, and they actually sound really good.
Everything sounds really good. We'll check back with them to see how the dishes turn out. A warm, hearty stew does sound so good right now.
All right, stew.
Daniel Gore in the kitchen.
It's one of those things, you know, you get going on your stove on a Saturday morning. It's there kind of bubbling away all afternoon. Makes the house smell like a home.
First order of business, cooking the beef brisket. Use a tough cut of meat for your stews because this is going to cook for 2 to 2.5 hours.
All righty. So we've got these nice big hunks of meat. You want them about an inch and a half inch to an inch cubes. I'm going to season this with a little bit of salt. Okay, and what that's going to do is it's going to start bringing the moisture to the surface of the meat. And then we're going to toss it in the flour. And it's going to give it a really nice color when we sear it. Also, the flour, as it cooks, it's going to thicken the liquids that we add later. And that's what's going to give your stew that nice, rich viscosity. Okay, we have a little bit of oil. Okay, I'm just adding this. You can hear it sizzling. I'm going to shake it around a little bit. We don't want anything to burn. You want to get that nice, what they call in French, a fond, which means a foundation or a base. And that's what the brown color is giving you. It's giving you that kind of rich, nutty, toasty flavor that you want, and you're going to let that beef really caramelize at the beginning. And give it the time. This is one of the most important parts of making a stew is this browning and this caramelization. Okay, once we have the meat all nicely caramelized, we're going to add our nice big chunky onions. And you want to have the onions about the same size as the meat. You want them to, you know, each have their own personality. So when you're eating the stew, you know, you're tasting all these different things. You don't want to dice all your vegetables up too fine. You want it to be kind of rustic and peasant-like.
Here we got the carrots.
Okay, we've got some nice big chunky carrots. And you can use whatever you have. You could use all different kinds of root vegetables, celery root, parsnip, turnips would be great in here. Of course, potatoes will add towards the end, about the last half an hour of the cooking, we add the potatoes, and we do that because we don't want the potatoes to fall apart and be all mushy. I'm going to put a couple orange peels in there. It's going to give it a kind of a unique flavor. Okay, I'm going to throw in a couple bay leaves, and of course, some whole cloves of garlic. See how that's turning nice and brown?
Oh yeah, look at that meat.
You can smell that. It's smelling roasted. And
oh, delicious.
Now we're going to add some red wine. Okay, and we're going to cook this until the red wine evaporates. It's going to start to thicken from the flour, and then we're just going to top it with a little bit of water and then stew it until it's tender, about 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Love this dish. Celery root, parsnip, turnips, potatoes. Perfect additions to this recipe. Lots of other recipes highlighting the beautiful qualities of root veggies at eartheats.org. Finally, we get to do some tasting of these Dutch oven dishes. Let's check out Scott's and Gabrielle's chicken tortilla right. soup.
I told you it was. It's been boiling for about 10 minutes now.
Give it a stir.
Look at that chicken in there. It looks good. Looks like it's done almost.
We're just using scoops. Tortilla scoops, and that's how we'll serve it.
Taste test.
All right, here we go.
Oh, hot.
Oh! Oh, oh hot.
That's really warm. That's fantastic. Are you happy with it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this is better than the first one that we did.
Oh my goodness, it just needs to cool down a little bit.
It's amazing how much heat these Dutch ovens hold inside, even with just 18 coals. Sue Nelson has plucked the coals off the lid to see how her peach upside down cake is doing.
Oh, what do you think?
Looks pretty good, huh?
I think it looks great.
It looks better than I thought it would be.
So this crazy Dutch oven thing worked out?
Yes, it baked quicker than, about 10 minutes quicker, too, than I had expected. And it didn't burn because I watched it twice. And the second time before I turned it now, it was pretty much puffed up. So I used my toothpick to check and make sure it was done.
So you're holding your ready-to-be-judge sign. You're clutching it. You are ready. Are you nervous?
No. I don't care if I win or not. It's been fun to be with all these people.
Sue's dish didn't win an award. Neither did Jonathan and Mindy's turkey soup. Scott and Gabrielle were encouraged with a second-place finish in the soup category. And what about Maria Hopper and her pumpkin pie? Well, she's 2 for 2. Another victory for her in the dessert category. Our day at Patoka Lake was so wonderful. See photos of the competitors at eartheats.org. Been a fun day today. Thanks for sharing it with us. Our crew includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Have a good one. See you next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.